As I was looking over some notes and making preparation, I started thinking, you know, it's easy to say, yeah, I'll teach that back in the time it's asked. And then when you start getting into it, you start thinking, oh, no. But I hope that the study has been somewhat profitable to you. I realize that we have not spent a lot of time going through every symbolic picture, all the symbolism of the book. I do want us to understand there are other views of the book. Some of my brethren have used to be the majority would take the late date that we've been looking at, that this was written probably about 96 A.D. by John as he's on the island of Patmos and Domitian is persecuting the church. There's been a little bit of a deviation now. It seems like there may be more who are teaching that this is really talking about the fall of Jerusalem. And if you take that position, the symbolism would mean something different. I don't consider that to be a false teaching. They're still saying that Jesus will be triumphant. I don't want to, I may think their view is wrong. They may think mine is wrong, but that doesn't mean you've dropped fellowship with somebody on a position like that. It's not an erroneous position or error as far as leading one astray, because at the end of the book, you'll find that whichever position you take, Jesus is triumphant. And there are people who are more scholarly, way more scholarly than I, that would take that position. I have noticed that and talked to more people who take that view nowadays than in days gone by. I take the late position for several reasons. Number one, it seems to fit some about the churches that we read about in 2 and 3. You know, they'd have had time to have been established and to have lost their first love. They would have had time to have gone through Nero's persecution and still had to be working through Domitian. If you take the early date, the fall of Jerusalem in 70, as saying that's what the Revelation is talking about, then you're right around Nero's time, and Paul would just have been put to death, and Peter not too far, or not too soon before that. But we're just going to concentrate on what we're studying, and the reason I tell you that is that you might have someone else come in, and he takes the early date, and he teaches that. Just remember this, whenever you make a study of the Revelation letter, three things are important. Number one, symbolism is important, but don't get bogged down in something we're not 100% sure about. And a lot of these things, we can make a scholarly guess, we can take what the scholars have said, and we can say, this is a possible meaning, this is what it could mean, and that is fine. But we need to remember that in the study of the Revelation letter, that it is using apocryphal writing, and sometimes that's a little confusing. There's a little book written by a brother out in Texas that talks about how to read apocryphal writing, and it's pretty useful. I haven't read it all the way through, but what I have read has been very useful. The second thing I want us to remember about when you study the Revelation letter that's very important is remember to get the overall picture. Don't get lost in all the scenery, that you forget what the overall picture is. Christians are being persecuted. Christians are being hurt, but God is paying attention. And so it doesn't matter which position you take on, whether it's the fall of Jerusalem or the fall of Rome. And like I said, I defend the fall of Rome. I believe that is what John is writing about because of the time period. But regardless, remember this, that it is revealing the fact that Christians are hurting, and that we can sometimes, as our world begins to evolve and you see a generation that's being raised not to believe in God, and you have professors in higher schools of education and institutions of higher learning are teaching children don't believe in God, and they don't just leave it at that. They mock people who believe in God. We need to remember that there are children, and our children's children are going to face a lot of things we didn't have to face. Now, when I was still in school, they had just started teaching about evolution, and I remember some of the kids would say, oh no, there is a God, and the teacher would say, okay, but we're going to look at it from the evolution standpoint. But now they even say there's a God, they're going to be mocked at. But the third thing we need to do is this. God will triumph. And when you get to the end of this book, if you've missed everything else, you didn't catch anything else Mike Richardson said, that's fine. You just remember one thing. God will be triumphant. And sometimes we get confused about the symbolism and we get confused about that. You just remember, God's people were hurting. God's people were being persecuted. God's people were suffering. And yet God said, I want you to remember, I'm going to bring judgment upon those who've brought this upon you, and I will be triumphant. And many times what happens is we lose fact of that. Sometimes we argue about some of the symbolism, and I've heard some classes where they've gotten really deep into what they think it means. Well, at the end of the book, remember what's being published. That's not to say that this other stuff's not important. It's very important. We want to try to be as accurate as we can and have the right position. I don't want you to misunderstand me or misrepresent me on that. If I didn't believe my position was right, I wouldn't hold that position. But at the same time, we want to continue to study with people and try to engage in our study and have some give and take so we can come to a better understanding of the Revelation letter. Well, we're in Revelation 17. And when you come to Revelation 17... Jerusalem fell in 70 A.D. Titus came in with the Roman power. In fact, the business, it was such a horrific fall, they ran out of wood to crucify people on. Rome was just utterly destroyed. In fact, in Josephus's Chronicles, he'd asked for two men who were being crucified to come down, and I don't know if either one survived. Maybe one hadn't been up very long, maybe have survived, but it was so unusual for anyone who once has been nailed to a cross to survive that kind of trauma. So Jerusalem, remember Jesus had even said about that, not one stone will be left unturned. But now when you get to the Revelation letter, he's really, in my opinion, talking about Rome. Jerusalem's already fallen, and what he's saying is, Rome continues to persecute Christians, and the Jews now, they've already been persecuted, and their city has been annihilated, and they're in the process of trying to figure out what to do. But Christians are the ones that are being targeted now. And now they've always been in Egypt because the Jews, the Romans, the Greeks, you name it, they could all agree we don't like the Christians. Because the Christians was an easy group to blame everything on. When Rome burned, we sometimes say Nero fiddled. I don't think they had fiddles then yet, according to one historian. So I don't really think he was out there with a fiddle, but what he's saying is Nero was happy that Rome burned because he could blame the Christians for it. Though he himself started the fire because he wanted a new dedication built to him, a new structure built in Rome that would give him glory. And because of the fire, people, some of the council, some of the Roman proconsul started to turn against Nero. Nero said, I didn't do it, the Christians did. Well, what do you think happened? Christians were being persecuted. They were always an easy target because they would not burn incense to the emperor. So you come these years later, you've had Caligula, you've had Domitian, you've had all these people who were so ungodly and so filthy that you could see that their disdain for anything that would be holy would be something that they would want to get rid of. But that's a great question. Probably went way more over than what you wanted. All right, in Revelation 17, notice he says in verse 1, then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and talked with me, saying to me, come, I will show you the judgment of the great harlot who sits on many waters, with whom the kings of the earth committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth were made drunk with wine of her fornication. So he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast, which was full of names of blasphemy, having seven heads and 10 horns. The woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet, and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls, having in her hand a golden cup full of abominations and the filthiness of her fornication. And on her forehead a name was written, Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and of the abominations of the earth. I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus, and when I saw her, I marveled with great amazement. That again takes me back to why I think it's Rome. As bad as the Jews persecuted the Christians, nowhere near as bad as Rome eventually would. So when you look at the five enemies that Christ has introduced in our study so far, we had the dragon. Who was the dragon representative of? Satan himself. Okay, then we had the sea beast. What were the sea beasts representative of? False nations. Then we had the earth beast, and it was representative of false religions. Then we had Babylon, which was representative really of Rome, or if you want to say the world. And then you have the men who bore the mark of the beast. They were those who had worshiped before Caesar. They were worldly people. So you have these individuals living in the very filth of sin. Now notice, if you will, as he's writing, that the word Babylon's mentioned. Now Babylon to the Jews meant something, because what happened when they fell in Old Testament days? They were taken into captivity into Babylon. Now this isn't talking about literal Babylon. He's talking about Rome here. Rome. He's talking about the nation that is going to persecute them. And so you have, remember in chapters 15 and 16, the men who received the mark of the beast. We now see in John's vision in chapter 17 what's going to befall upon Babylon, Rome, the sea beast, and the earth beast. And so the dragon's defeat is going to be described later in Revelation 20. However, it's greatly important that we see all this attached to Rome as the center of all persecuting power, that the three whole chapters are giving to portraying her doom. And we're going to be looking at those three chapters. It's talking about the fall of Rome. Now, in chapter 17, we've read those first six verses. Let's read down and notice something else in verse 7. But the angel said to me, "Why did you marvel? I will tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast that carries her, which has the seven heads and the ten horns." Now, I want you to notice a contrast. In verse 5, she had on her forehead written mystery. And in verse 7, the angel says, "I will reveal this mystery to you." A mystery is just something that's unknown. Remember Paul, when he was writing to the church at Ephesus in Ephesians 3, talked about the unknown mystery, which was the gospel at that time, but he said, now it's been revealed to you. A mystery is only something we don't know, but once it's known, it's no longer a mystery. It's been revealed. So he is talking about, I'm going to reveal this to you so it'll no longer be a mystery. Now, let's look at verse 1. Notice in verse 1, he shows judgment will come upon the great harlot. And I'm using New King James. I know Old King James Version has another word there, but it doesn't matter. He's saying this is someone who had prostituted themselves spiritually. Now, I want you to think about that, and I know we get uncomfortable with that, but the picture is this. People are to be faithful to God. And what we need to remember is the importance of a covenant as Christians we make with God. And people who do not, they're committing spiritual adultery. And that is something we have to recall. We need to be pure as the people of God, that we don't sell out. That we do not become guilty of becoming a spiritual harlot. And notice, so he says, I will show you the judgment of the great harlot. Committed spiritual adultery, the one who is in sin. And now notice this statement, waters. That symbolizes the people of the empire, verse 15. People that she ruled over, the people that she was in charge of, they're going to have to listen to this great judgment. Now look in verse 2. People of all walks of life committed spiritual fornication, forgetting God. Notice that statement. The kings of the earth committed fornication. And the inhabitants of the earth were made drunk with wine of her fornication. Remember in the Old Testament, what happened when the nation became so vile? God gave the picture of a prostitute. What does he say? I'm divorcing you because you've not kept our covenant faithfully. You have went after foreign gods. And so that's the same picture here. God is looking out And he's saying, here's a nation and the kings are committing spiritual adultery, spiritual fornication. They've forgotten God. And so the political and the economic and the religious world were in spiritual harlotry. And so God is a God who expects faithfulness, and he has every right to expect it. So look at the next verse. In verse 3, he carries them away in a spirit to a vision. And now notice the things he sees in this. He sees the woman. Now we remember the woman is Rome. Look at verse 18. And the woman whom you saw is the great city which reigns over the kings of the earth. Who's that? Rome. So he sees Rome as being defiled, as being spiritually unclean. And then he sees the woman dressed with a scarlet-colored robe. Really, the blood-stained beast is which upon which she rode is talking about the guiltiness of the killings of the people. And notice the support that she had, the empire that she is ahead of. And then look, notice the attributes, seven heads. What did we say seven meant? Complete. That showed wisdom. The ten horns shows power. So you get down to verse 4 and you have the apparel of the purple and scarlet, and she rides as a queen. She thinks she's in charge. I think about that. You have the scarlet beast, and then you have the scarlet robe. That just shows the epitome of wickedness. The empire, depending upon the beast, she's depending upon the beast for support. It's blood-stained beast that she rode upon, and now she is arrayed with purple and scarlet, rides as a queen, and notice she holds a cup. And what's in the cup? The unclean things of her fornication. And so you have evil which comes forth from her evil works. And the mystery of Babylon, the great mother of the harlots, she was a mystery, she was a wonder. She was able to cause people to worship Rome. And so Rome of that day, if you drop down to verse 18, Babylon symbolizing Rome is the symbol of all that is worldly and lustful. Now think about it from this standpoint. I'm going to be very careful how I use this illustration, but I don't want it to be inappropriate, but I want you to think about it from this standpoint. If you're a Christian, you can't sell out for anything unless we become a spiritual harlot. Years ago, George Bernard Shaw, who was a playwright, became intoxicated over in England, and he was trying to have this woman do some things that were ungodly, and he offered her money, and she said, no. And he said, offered her more money, and she said, what do you think I am? When he offered her £1 million, she said, maybe. When he offered her £25, she said, what do you think I am? He said, we've already established what you are when you agreed to the £1 million. We're just negotiating price. I don't say that to be inappropriate. I say that to this. If we're become spiritual harlots, all the devil has to do is find our price. And what price will you sell out for? Isn't that a scary thought? That the devil is looking to say, what will Mike Richardson give up his faith for? And that's what he's looking with each of us. What would it take for you to say, that Christianity, that's too much, I'm done? Because that's the price the devil's looking for. And I say that so that we remember in our heads, there's no price worth our soul. There's nothing worth selling your soul over. And so here at this time, persecution, if they're being whipped and beaten, mistreated, losing loved ones, you would think if ever there was a time to say, okay, Lord, I quit, that'd be it. And the Lord says, no, you don't quit yet. You've made a covenant that you'd be my people, and that covenant is through death. Do you see the picture? And so you think Babylon, the great mother, she was a mystery. She was able to cause the people to worship the beast. She is Rome of that day. And symbolizing all that is worldly and lustful. And notice that statement in verse 6. Every time I read that, it just makes me almost sick. She, she delights to drink the blood of the martyrs. That's not literal. That's symbolic of she enjoys killing Christians. And I thought about, don't ever think that can't happen in this land. Don't ever think that they won't ever come in and say, we're done with Christianity. Now look at what he says in verses 7 through 12. We have the picture again of the woman. And when the angel had already asked, we said, why do you marvel? I'll tell you what the mystery is. And he said, the beast that you saw was and is not and will ascend out of the bottomless pit. And he says in verse 8, and go to perdition. And those who dwell on the earth will marvel whose names are not written in the book of life and the foundation of the world when they see the beast that was and is and yet is. Is not and yet is. Here is the mind which was wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sits. Now that's talking about Rome. Rome was built upon seven mountains in verses 9 through 12. And so the world's going to wonder what happened to the woman, but Christians are told what happened. And so he says Rome is going to fall. The seven heads, the kings which formed the foundations of the great empire, they're going to fall. Look at that again in verse 9. Here's the mind which was wisdom in verse 9. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sits. There are also seven kings. Five have fallen. One is, and the other has not yet come. Five emperors, one reigning now, one to come, and he must continue a short time. Now you think they'd be relieved to hear that? The beast that was and is not is himself, also the eighth and is up to the seventh, is going to perdition. The ten horns which you saw are ten kings who have received no kingdom as yet, but they receive authority for 1 hour as kings with the beast. Now, he gives us that picture. He gives the seven heads, kings which form the foundation of the empire. Verse 11, the eighth is one of the seven, symbolic of evil work being relived in another ruler after this. Then he talks about the ten horns, the power of the empire. Her power and her provinces, symbolic as ten kings, must refer to the rulers of the Roman provinces who receive authority from Rome, and they enjoy the delegated authority for a short time. He gives them 1 hour. That's just a short time. But he's going to remove their power. So look at verses 13 and 14. These are of one mind, and they will give their power and authority to the beast. They only have one thought. What's their one thought? To obey Rome and to persecute Christians. So in verse 14, they make spiritual war with the Lamb. These will make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb will overcome them. Can you imagine finally get that? Your brother has been put to death. You're hiding in catacombs, worshiping, and he says, they're going to make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb will overcome them, for He is Lord of lords and King of kings, and those who are with Him are called chosen and faithful. That's what they needed to hear. Then he said to me, the waters which you saw where the harlot sits are peoples, multitudes, nations, and tongues, and the ten horns which you saw on the beast, these will hate the harlot, make her desolate and naked, eat her flesh and burn her with fire. For God has put it into their hearts to fulfill her purpose, to be of one mind, and to give their kingdom of the beast until the works of God are fulfilled. And the woman whom you saw is the great city, that's talking about Rome, which reigns over the kings of the earth. So he says in verses 15 through 18, the time is coming when these provinces will have their part in their destruction. And this was one of the greatest fears Rome had, which can easily be seen in the book of Acts. There was fear in Rome for any kind of turmoil or unrest. They are afraid of a revolution. You ever noticed, and I think it's dangerous, it makes you wonder, when people get power, what do they always try to do? At any cost. Keep it. Don't they? They'll fight for it. They don't want to lose control of power. And power corrupts, but what does absolute power do? Absolutely corrupts. And so the time of the destruction is coming. And that's this revolution's coming. The fall would be at the hands of other nations. They're going to finally have the external component. They've already had, we've talked about the internal rottenness, and we've talked about the natural calamities. But the first triumph picture of the Christians is the certain doom of Emperor Rome. And while the world power is apparently doing the will of the beast or dragon, God is working above all of them. And I tell you, one of the most beautiful things you'll find in 17 is two different things. He brings up the book of life again, but this time it's those who do not have their name in the book of life. Can I say something? And I hope it comes out the way I mean for it to. Sometimes I think it through and don't know whether to say it or not, but I want to say this. If your name's not in the book of life, then you're no different than Nero as far as being an enemy of God. Because there's something in this world you love more than God. And God said, I do not take second place. And so here you see the mystery being revealed. And I thought about that statement. In verse 14, they will make war with the Lamb. What a mistake. Because the Lamb will overcome them. Isn't that what Jesus has always said? What did He say back in John 16? I've overcome the world. He said it then, even before He's even been crucified. It can be said in the present tense like that, or past tense like that, because it is definitively certain He will. Any questions or comments about 17? Oh, yes. Yes. Amen. And you know what? One of the most mind-boggling things for me to wrap my mind around is this. When Christians were persecuted is when the gospel spread the most. You would think, well, I don't want to be a part of that. They're killing you. And yet, that's when it spread them on. We've had it easy for so long in this country that it's getting harder to convert because people they've put their trust in everything. But this time, with Rome ruling and reigning, Christianity was growing. Just something. I'm going to make a statement. I hope it comes out right. A lot of Christendom today, and I'm not talking about the church, but just in people who believe in Christ, there is a mindset that as long as I make God a part of my life, He should just bless the rest of my life. And I call suburban Christians, what they are they think that, or have a belief, or seem to have this belief, that Christianity only gives bless you more and more as far as your bank account and everything. Never taught in Scripture. Never brought out in Scripture. In fact, it brings out, like you say, you might as well be prepared to suffer for the cause of the one you love. Yeah, you think about this. I've known of a couple that got married sooner than they planned to because the woman was about to die. And they wanted to be married. And I thought about, he knew he was marrying someone who was about to die, but he loved her so much and she loved him so much, they went ahead and moved the wedding up, and I don't think it was much time later till she died. And you know what? Would you marry someone you thought was going to die right away? Some people say yes, some people say no. But you think about that kind of love. Now you think about the love of being for God. God's never going to die. But we physically will. But God's love is invested in. You have something, Brother John? Yeah. That's exactly what it means more to you. It's precious to you. Then you're going to hold on to good. Good thought, John. Appreciate that. Oh, yeah. I bet it was like here, like it was in Charlotte, Tennessee. We had folding chairs out. That lasted about 2 weeks. And everyone started to go back to their life. And the thing about it is, I see if I can say this in the right way. My brain's kind of slow today, so you got to forgive me, but Mary will probably contest it's slow most days. I'm not supposed to mention you from up here. I'm sorry. You ever thought about if you only came to God when you needed Him, how much of an insult that is? Now, I don't mean that. I've seen people gone out in the world, like you said, and they've come back because they've hit bottom. I'm glad they've seen their error of their way, but they come back with full commitment. But what worries me is I've had people call me up, and I've gone to their house in the middle of the night. I never forget a gentleman drunk, wanting to talk to me about his life, and at that time, unfaith. And what he wanted to do was have a little bit of assurance, but he didn't have any commitment. And I thought, what kind of relationship is that? The church, we're the bride of Christ. We're to be faithful to the groom. We're to be totally faithful. And then he calls us the bride. And in fact, the business, if you just go over, look, you'll see where he says that the bride came down in beauty. And I think about, we'll talk more about that when we get to it. But go to John 21. Look what he says in verse 2. I, John, saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. That's what the church is. Why is the church subject to Christ? We're the bride. He's the groom. What does the church do? The church worships and fulfills the will of the groom. And so when you look at what he says, we need to be faithful to it. I'll tell you what, a lot of this probably just hitting me more than anyone else, but I think about faithfulness, and I think about how much work I've got to do. Not because I think I'm going to earn it, but because I think I need to show my God more respect and reverence. Any questions or comments up to chapter 18? Yeah, I didn't even catch you say. Yeah, it's Activity 316. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I knew what you meant. Anything else? Elders have anything they want to say? Anybody else? All right. Before we get it, we don't have time to get into 18. I just want to make this plea with us. As we, the bride of Christ, the people of God, let us remember our responsibility, as he says in verse 17, is to follow the Lamb who is Lord of lords and King of kings. I want to ask you this question. If Christ is King in your life, are you being insubordinate to Him? That doesn't mean sometimes we don't sin, fall short, and don't keep the... That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about what's our mindset about the King. Do we love coming to worship Him, or is this a drudgery? Do we love studying more about Him, or is this a bore to everybody? The question is this. What you love, you invest in. And this is going to be a weak comparison, but I'll tell it anyway. I had a friend of mine, Kevin Clark. I don't know if Kevin ever preached here. Lawyer down in Birmingham. Big Tennessee fan. And when I moved to Alabama, I said, I'm a little worried about it. He said, don't worry, he said, it will empower you with your Tennessee fandom. Just joke. We just said, it'll make you be, you'll embrace it more because you have to hold on to it because nobody else is there to encourage you. And we just was joking about that because football is nothing compared to the seriousness of what we're talking about. But I do want you to think about this. Can you tell me who was the last Heisman Trophy winner for Alabama? Yes. Can you tell me who the first Heisman Trophy was for Alabama? Even I can tell you that. Can you tell me how many national championships Alabama has won? How many did Bear Bryant win? How many Nick Saban win? You know the numbers. And you may say, well, why are you saying all that? Can you tell me what Ephesians 5:19 says off the top of your head? Can you tell me what Colossians 3:16 says? Can you tell me what John 3:1 and 2 says? Can you tell me what 1 Timothy 2:16 says? Why is it we know more about football than we do our God? And that includes my Christians. Could it be we're more invested in that than we are this? Could it mean that means more to us on a Saturday so that we're even late getting here on Sunday if it's a late game? And that's the word I keep reminding myself because I have been just as guilty. It's a game. Tennessee loses, I used to get mad for a week. We lost so much lately, I'd have rage issues if I hadn't quit doing that. But I'll tell you what I've learned. It's just a game. Those players, they appreciate your fandom, but what have they done for you? They're playing a game for them. They're playing a game they enjoy. But when you think of that compared to a spiritual truth, God has invested in you more than you can imagine. How can we love something that is here more than... And it's not wrong to love football. Don't get me wrong. Please do not misunderstand. It's not wrong to love sports. But remember who the king is. I remember one time, and I'll close with this. I may have got myself in trouble today, but I want to say this. There was a lady that came forward, and she confessed her sin. She said she had left her first love. And the preacher got up and said, "Sister so-and-so has confessed she left her first love." The man turned to his wife and said, "I didn't know she left Joe." That's a problem. As much as you love your spouse, your first love is Christ. If not, you have him in the wrong place. Do you see the importance of revelation? Your life comes to depend on what is precious. As Brother John said, Brother John really opened all that up for you. Don't get take it out on him, but he's right. What is precious is what you hold dear. What you're invested in, that's what you'll remember. Thank you for studying with me.